You're listening to the Deal Farm Podcast with Ken Corsini, educating, inspiring, and connecting you to real estate deals. And now, your host, Ken Corsini.
Hey, this is Ken Corsini with the Deal Farm. On today's Best Deal Ever episode, I've got Paula Pant. Paula, how you doing?
I'm awesome. How are you doing?
I'm doing very good. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm excited.
Very cool. Well, I'm excited about this one too. This is our first full-time blogger that we've had on the show, and that's actually something I know a little bit about. I've done a ton of blogging myself with Bigger Pockets, but Paula's created her own blog. It's called affordanything.com. And it's specifically about long-term buy and hold real estate investing. And she has grown a newsletter up to over 20,000 subscribers. And it sounds like every month you're adding maybe an extra 1,000 to that, if not more. Mm-hmm. I'm just so intrigued about how you've grown a newsletter and how you've built an audience in such a short amount of time. So we'll get into that. She's currently in Las Vegas, but she invests in my backyard, which is in Atlanta. And she has, how many rental properties do you have right now, Paula?
I have 7 units.
7 units. Okay, perfect. Well, I want to know, I guess, before you even started investing in real estate and starting to build a portfolio of rental properties, what were you doing? What was the impetus to get you into real estate?
Oh, I kind of fell into real estate on accident. So my background, I used to write for a newspaper.
Okay.
Way back in the day. Uh-huh. And I'd always wanted to travel. When I was in college, I really wanted to go study abroad, but I didn't have the money. I couldn't afford it. And so when I graduated from college, I thought I'm going to work for a few years, save up some money, and then just go and travel for a while. And so that was exactly what I did. I worked for a newspaper. I stayed there for a few years. I saved up about $25,000. And then in 2008, I quit and then just went off and traveled for a while. So I was, basically, you know, there was absolutely no career related or financial related justification for that decision. In fact, a lot of people told me I was committing career suicide. They said I'd never get a job again. And hey, I didn't.
It worked out all right, didn't it?
Exactly. So from 2008 to 2010, I was traveling in countries where the dollar exchange rate really worked in my favor. So I was in Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam, and just kind of like goofing off and doing absolutely nothing other than having fun. Wow. Which was fantastic. I highly recommend it.
How many people are listening right now that are just so jealous that you actually pulled the trigger and did what everybody else dreams about doing?
Thank you.
That is so cool. Now, were you by yourself or were you with friends kind of during different parts of the traveling?
For part of it, I was by myself, but then for a lot of it, I was with my boyfriend.
Gotcha. Okay. Mm-hmm. So he was along for the ride. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So a lot of Asia, Southeast Asia, or were you guys all over the world?
Well, I started with a one-way ticket to Cairo. And from that point, I just had no idea what to do. So I spent 6 weeks in Egypt. That was before the Arab Spring Revolution. So it was a very different Egypt than the one that you would experience today.
Sure.
And from there, I went into Israel, spent a few weeks there. Came back to Egypt, flew over to India, and then kind of traveled around through India and Nepal, and then decided to do the Southeast Asia loop. So at that point, I went to Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, Myanmar, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia. And then I capped it off with 10 months of camping in Australia. So.
Oh my gosh. Well, you had plenty of material to write about, I guess, after you were done for the year and a half, 2 years that you traveled. That's pretty awesome. So I'm just curious, where did you stay? I mean, were you staying at hostels or how did you do that affordably?
Yeah, the average cost of where I was staying was about $5 to $10 a night.
Wow.
So in Southeast Asia, and again, I stayed in countries where the dollar exchange rate really worked in my favor. That was key.
Yeah.
And the one country that violated that rule was Australia, New Zealand.
Yeah.
But so when I was there, I never stayed in hostels because that would have been a bit too expensive, a bit out of my budget. So that was why I decided to style that as a camping trip.
Gotcha. And so you were, when you were traveling around, were you sightseeing the whole time, hanging out, getting to know people and just experience the local flavor?
I mean, like, typically what happens, and I've heard this from a lot of travelers, is that in the beginning you're really into the sights. So when we were in Egypt, we were like, oh, the pyramids, the Sphinx, the this, the that, Hatshepsut's tomb. You know, you're kind of doing that more typical tourist thing. But then after a while, you start to slow down, and you're much more interested in meeting people than in seeing things.
I could see that. And so, do you feel like you made friends kind of along the way that you've even kept in touch with?
Yeah, there are a number of people. We're in touch on Facebook, so, you know, we'll comment and like on each other's photos. But yeah, I've got friends, travel buddies all over the world now who I met during that 2 year span.
Did you, I guess staying in a hostel too, did you feel like it was pretty international? You met people probably from all over the world staying in hostels?
Absolutely. There were surprisingly few Americans. I met a lot of people from Great Britain, a number of especially in Southeast Asia, you meet a number of Australians. And the type of people that you meet also depends very much on where you are. Like, for example, if you're in Bali, if you're on Kuta Beach, there tend to be more like 16-year-old Australians who are just experiencing beer for the first time. So it wasn't really my scene. But if you go into like Ubud, which is in the highlands, you tend to meet more like artist types. So, you know, you kind of word of mouth travels, and you learn from other travelers, and you just find out like where to go and where not to go. And but yeah, I met a lot of people, mostly Europeans, a lot of French travelers, a lot of German travelers, and a few travelers from Switzerland, met a guy from Luxembourg.
Crazy. So, yeah. And so were you using like train to get around? Or, I mean, $25,000 is a lot of money, but for, you know, over a year time span, that's still, you're still.
It was 2 years, actually.
It was two full years of traveling on 25 grand.
Yeah. Gosh. So I kept my living costs to, on average, about $1,000 a month. So, but that was, you know, eating local foods. Like, I wasn't paying a surplus for the type of foods that you would eat in America. Like, I wasn't eating cheese, for example. You know, I was eating Vietnamese food in Vietnam. I was eating Laotian food in Laos. So yeah, eating local foods, eating a lot of like street food. I didn't drink alcohol because that's expensive.
Yeah. Do you eat grasshoppers and all sorts of weird bugs that you see in the street markets on TV?
No, I was mostly vegetarian because I was concerned about, just a little bit concerned about getting food poisoning from street food.
Oh, yeah.
So I kept my diet to mostly vegetarian. And that was also another way to save money as well.
Okay. You know,
it's expensive.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. What an amazing experience. 2 years of just traveling. Crazy. So what was that like just re-entering the United States and kind of getting your feet under you again?
Oh, well, that was the impetus for real estate investing, because I came back to the U.S. and I thought, I don't want to get a job. I will do anything.
Yeah, right.
I will do absolutely anything as long as I don't have to get a job. Because I just could not imagine having to wake up to an alarm and commute through traffic and sit in a cubicle under like fluorescent strip lighting that just, oh no, no.
I don't blame you.
And so the first thing that I did was, because my background was as a newspaper reporter, I thought, well, I could become a full-time freelance writer. And so I started kind of devoting my efforts to really trying to make a full-time go of that. And it was slow getting off the ground. Freelance writing is not a very lucrative profession. And I had done a little bit of freelance writing while I was traveling. Not much. Like, I would do maybe one article a month. So it wasn't by any stretch of the imagination, it wasn't like a quote unquote significant source of income, but you know, it was enough that I kind of kept my contacts alive, kept my network alive. I had some recent clips in my portfolio that I could show to editors. So that helped. And so, yeah, I started building up this kind of modest but comfortable existence as a full-time self-employed freelance writer. And at the time that I was doing that, I was renting one unit within a triplex in Midtown Atlanta. And I kind of, you know, you can go on Zillow and you can see how much your landlord paid for the place. And because I'm nosy, I did that. I was like, well, I know what I'm paying. You know, I know what this unit rents for. I have a pretty good idea of what the other two units rent for. And I looked up what the landlord had purchased the house for, and I ran the numbers, and I was like, my landlord's getting a terrible deal. This is awful.
Yeah, right.
Because my landlord was getting a deal at which the rent more or less equaled his mortgage. So, you know, that meant that any repairs or maintenance or vacancies had to come out of his pocket.
Oh, wow. So even across all three units, he yeah. was only just breaking even, you feel like. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're right. That's exactly. not so great.
So so I knew that my landlord was getting a bunk deal, and I was like, oh, yeah, real estate probably sucks. And then I noticed a for sale sign in the triplex across the street, in the yard of the triplex across the street. And just out of curiosity, I had no really intention to become a real estate investor, but I thought, well, let's check it out. And so I, that particular house had been on the market for, I think, 16 months at that point, maybe 18 months. And it had gone under contract three times and for various reasons had fallen out of contract all three of those times. It was a short sale. The owner was imminently about to go into foreclosure. And so I made a absurdly lowball offer, lowball to the point where I thought that I was worried that I was going to insult them, and they accepted it. So that was awesome.
Yeah. Well, probably right timing. What year was this?
This was 2010.
Yep. Great timing.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a very, very good timing at that one. So yeah, so I made the lowball offer. I had, you know, unfortunately I had not had a very, I had had 2 years of self-employment, in terms of tax records. So mm-hmm. I, you know, on paper looked like I'd had the same job for the past 2 years, but it wasn't a very high, quote unquote, high paying job.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the terrible interest rate. You know, I got a 5.3% interest rate at a time when everybody else was getting 2.9%. So that was the price I paid for being self-employed and having that unconventional life. But, you know, even with that high interest rate, I was able to take out a mortgage and buy that as my first property. And then I, you know, because it was a triplex, I could move into one of the units and rent out the other two. And in fact, I took it a step further. I moved into one of the units with roommates and then rented out the others.
Man, there you go.
So I was very scrappy at the beginning, really bootstrapping.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the rent that I was getting from the other units plus the roommates that I had more than covered, not just covered the mortgage, but it also covered all of my expenses, that, you know, repairs, maintenance. It didn't cover major, major CapEx. You know, I ultimately decided to really put a lot of money into renovating that. And so I had to take out another loan to do a massive renovation. But like it more than covered the monthly nut, which meant that I lived for free, quote unquote. And when I saw that I was doing that, I thought, you know, I should really learn more about this real estate thing.
Yeah.
Because at that point, I wasn't coming at it from the perspective of an investor. At that point, I was just coming at it from the perspective of some kid trying to figure out a way to live for free.
Right. Right.
And so when I saw that I could do that, I thought, you know, I should actually get serious about learning about real estate. I should figure out what I'm doing. And so that was when I began my real estate education, and began learning a more systematic approach. And once I did that, I saw the possibilities that were out there, and I began pretty well, I don't know, aggressively is in the eye of the beholder, but at a rate of approximately one property per year, I began purchasing single family homes as long-term buy and hold rentals. And I did that for two reasons. Number one, my goal was not to have a full-time job in real estate. My goal was to avoid having a full-time job. And so I figured that if I could approach a long-term buy and hold strategy, I could create a stream of passive income, a stream of ongoing residual income that I could live on while I am traveling or hiking or skiing or camping or doing any of those other things that I love. So my goal wasn't, to you know, be some millionaire, multimillionaire house flipper. My goal was to have passive income coming through the door while I sleep.
Right. Right.
So that I can focus on living the rest of my life.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that was why I approached the buy and hold strategy. And then as far as one single family home per year, I mean, that just felt like a very reasonable pace. You know, I was worried that if I bought too many properties too quickly, I might get in over my head. But one single family home per year was just, it was manageable. I could wrap my head around it. It felt like a very slow and steady wins the race approach.
Absolutely. I'm curious what you did in terms of educating yourself. You said, you know, after you got your triplex, you said, hey, this is working out pretty nice. I need to learn a little bit more. Just curious where you went to get your education on real estate investing.
I've read a bajillion books. I've looked at a bunch of websites. I mean, I've spent hundreds of hours, probably thousands of hours just reading.
Yeah. The truth is there's so much out there available that's free. And, you know, books are inexpensive, but I mean, there's so many even good resources in terms of websites out there that you can digest and learn almost everything you need to know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you set out, I guess, to buy one house a year, and that's been over how many years now? About 7 years?
No, the triplex was in 2010.
Okay.
And then 2011, I didn't buy anything. Okay. And wait, is that right? 2011? When did I buy house number two? Let me think about this. I bought the second house in... Give me 1 second, I'm pulling it up. Yeah, 2011, I didn't buy anything.
Okay.
2012, I bought a foreclosed single family home, 3-bed, 2-bath.
Mm-hmm.
2012, I bought two homes in 2012. So nothing in 2011, two homes in 2012, one home in 2013, one home in 2014. And then I bought my own personal residence in 2015, finally.
Oh, wow. So this whole time you were living in the triplex?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, exactly.
Bought in 2015. I mean, and all the while, this wasn't even a full-time gig for you. I mean, at this point, you're doing freelance writing and blogging and whatnot. This was all very much on the side, just accumulating slowly a portfolio of cash-flowing properties.
Exactly.
Which, you know, your average investor that probably listens to The Deal Farm or is interested in real estate investing, that is what they're interested in. They're not necessarily interested in being a full-time flipper or wholesaler or whatever. They just want to slowly build their wealth and acquire a house here and a house there. And I think one per year is an excellent goal for building a portfolio.
I totally agree. I'm not a fan of the get rich quick, high risk, high leverage. Like my strategy is simple, straightforward, manageable, just slow and steady wins the race. This is not a sprint, it's a marathon. So
yep. So what are your long-term goals in terms of continuing to buy long-term rentals?
Well, you know, my initial goal when I started was I wanted to make $50,000 a year in net passive income. So okay. after all expenses, I wanted to be pocketing $50,000 a year. And the reason that I set that goal was because according to the U.S. Census Bureau, the average U.S. household income is $52,000 annually. And so my thinking was, well, you know, if I can create the average U.S. household income passively with minimal input from me, and my definition of passive is less than 1 hour a week. Then that's awesome. I've won the game.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah, that's right. You won.
At this point, I've done that. And so now I'm at that stage where I'm like, geez, I just met my goal. What do I do now? You know, do I double down? Do I say, all right, now I want to create $100,000 in passive income?
Yeah.
What do you do once you hit your goal? So that's an excellent question.
Yeah. Well, and there's nothing to say. You can't just say, all right, I hit it. I'm just going to sit tight, let these suckers appreciate and continue to build wealth in that regard.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's always a difficult question. Do you buy more properties or do you pay down the ones you have?
True.
I think about that question every single day. And it's because there's no right answer. It's because there are such good pros and cons on both sides.
Yeah.
That, you know, if at 9 o'clock at night I decide, yeah, I'm definitely going to do option A, then by the time I wake up at 9 o'clock the next morning, I'm like, nah, maybe I like option B.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to decide. So my strategy has been save up, save up cash. You can never go wrong with having cash.
Yep.
And once you accumulate sufficient cash that you could throw all of that cash at one of your mortgages and pay down a property, then at that point, look around at the market. And if there's a great property that you could either buy in cash or make a substantial down payment on a property, then awesome. You've got the resources to do that. And if there's not a property that's really calling to you, then don't buy something just for the sake of buying something.
Sure.
You know, if there's nothing that's calling to you, hey, wipe out one of your mortgages.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it's tricky too, because you probably bought these when interest rates were super low and you bought it at a really good price. I mean, that's
I paid terrible interest rates.
Oh, did you really? On all of them?
Yeah. I mean, my highest interest rate is 7%.
Wow.
You know?
Interesting.
Yeah. And it was because I didn't have that standard traditional job history.
Yeah. Right.
So,
you
know, I didn't have a nice W-2 paycheck. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, I got screwed on interest rates as a result. But, you know, I bought good properties so that despite the fact that I paid terrible interest rates, they still work.
They still work. You're still clearing your goal of 50 grand a year in passive income.
Yeah.
What if at some point in time, you know, before rates go up, you could always go back and probably refi some of those and get your cash flow even higher.
Yeah, that's true.
So let's talk a little bit about how you also made the transition during this period of time into having a full-time blog about real estate investing, because that really intrigues me. So mm-hmm. When did that really happen?
So I started the blog in 2011, and initially I started it because I was trying to create a career as a freelance writer, and everybody says, well, if you're a professional writer, you should really have a blog. So initially I did it just for that.
Mm-hmm.
And also I guess there were two reasons. Partly it was because of that, and partly it was because while I was traveling, the single most frequent response that I would get from people was, oh, I would love to travel, but I can't afford it. Mm-hmm. Everybody said that. And yet these were the same people who drove expensive SUVs. They had their hair highlighted, their fingernails were manicured. They had these designer like Gucci Prada purses, and they were like, I'd love to travel, but I can't afford it. And here I am, like, you know, eating street cart noodles in Vietnam, like
right.
Not drinking alcohol because it was too expensive, where, you know, and they're like ordering this, sipping this $14 martini, telling me that they can't afford to travel.
That's right. It's all relative, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so I started Afford Anything to promote the idea that you can afford anything, you just can't afford everything. So if there's something that you want to do, I don't care what it is, whether it's become a real estate investor or travel the world or pay cash for your car or whatever, I don't know, purchase the entire fleet of Gucci products, like whatever your dream is, I'm not judging your dream, pick your dream. But whatever that is, you can afford to do that. You just can't afford to do that and X and Y and Z.
That's right.
So that was the other reason that I started Afford Anything. And initially, I didn't start it with the intention of it being a real estate-focused website. But I happened to be investing in real estate over that span of time. And you know, and because you just tend to write about what you're thinking about, you write about what's on your mind. I ended up just writing a lot about real estate because that was what I was thinking about. And then I, by virtue of doing that, just attracted an audience of people who were interested in real estate investing, and specifically buy and hold rental property investing.
It's just, again, out of curiosity, because I do a little bit of social media, but I'm not Mr. Social Media by any stretch. How do you get the word out for a new blog? Because some people are listening thinking, man, I'd love to do that. I love writing, or mm-hmm. it'd be fun to talk about one. But how does that snowball into 20,000 subscribers?
Well, for one thing, I've been at it for a while. So I started the blog in 2011. So I've been at it for 5 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me 4 years to build the first 10,000 subscribers. Mm. And so at the beginning of 2015, I had some ballpark somewhere around 10,000. So it took me 4 years to build the first 10,000 and then 1 year to double that. So that's part of it. Part of it is just, it's the long-term strategy. It's just like real estate investing. You just do it slowly over the span of a long time. And you know, like gardening or like any kind of harvesting, you eventually reap the rewards.
Yeah.
You front load that workload and eventually reap the rewards over the long term.
Yep.
So that's part of it. Part of it is just writing really good content. There is a lot of crap out there. There really is. There's a lot of noise. There are a lot of people who, when they blog, they're just trying to check off a box. And readers can tell. Like, readers can tell when you write stuff that's boring and uninspired and unoriginal. I sometimes put 20 hours into a single blog post.
Wow.
I don't do that for every post, but some of my blog posts are, it's not just an article, it's a reader experience. It's got graphs, it's got charts, it's got photos and images and jokes and it's a full-on experience. And when readers see that, they become engaged, they become part of that community. Part of it, frankly, is just be better than everybody else. There's this great quote by, who's that comedian? Steve Martin. Mm-hmm. There's this quote by Steve Martin where he says, be so good they can't ignore you.
That's good. Yeah.
And that's my approach to blogging. Don't be part of the noise. Don't create mediocre content produces less than mediocre results. But above average content yields disproportionate results.
That is such a good point too, because there is so much noise on the internet and there is so much average content, not just average content, but repackaged content. Yeah. Everybody's writing the same crap and just rewording it. I mean, there's people that have professions of spinning articles because it's just regurgitating the same stuff that's out there. So that's really, really, really good advice. Is there's no shortcuts. Just take the time and put out really, really entertaining, good content. And I guess naturally you start to build an audience as a result of that.
Yeah, exactly.
How are you getting the word out though? Were you starting with just like your own network of people and kind of pushing it out there, and next thing you know, they're telling their friends and they're telling their friends and it blows up? I mean, because a lot of people could start a blog and there's no traffic signs pointing you to the blog, nobody's ever going to find your website. Nobody's ever going to find your blog. So at some point you have to find ways to steer people to your site. Just curious what you were doing initially to help people find you.
Well, a couple of things. In the beginning, I haven't done this in a while, but especially in the beginning, 2011, 2012, I was writing a lot of guest posts for other people's websites. So, I would write an article for their site and it would be good. And then at the bottom, they would just say, hey, if you like this article, check out my own site, Afford Anything. Mm-hmm. And so that brought in an initial flux of people.
Were you on BiggerPockets?
Yeah, for a while I was. I wrote for them for about a year.
I knew I recognized you. You and I were both contributors to BiggerPockets.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah,
it's so funny because I was like, Paul Payne, how do I know that name? How do I know that? when we were introduced, I was like, it just dawned on me that we were both contributing to BiggerPockets at the same time.
Oh, so cool.
You were leveraging some of that audience, I guess, which is awesome. I mean, that's 100% the way you should do it.
Absolutely. I've been thinking about maybe starting to write for them again. Josh and Brandon are both good friends of mine. I was on the BiggerPockets podcast. I was one of the early ones. I was episode 34 or 36, something like that. Oh, very
cool. Yeah.
And so that was another way that I did it, was I just went out there and I formed relationships. I mean, friendships, like not just casual relationships, but really deep, true friendships with a lot of other bloggers, particularly bloggers in the finance and real estate space. Mm-hmm. So BiggerPockets, for example, I don't know Josh as well, but Brandon, I mean, I could email him a dirty joke right now, like we have that level of kind of a relationship.
That's cool.
There are a lot of personal finance bloggers. There's a conference every year called the Financial Bloggers Conference, known as FinCon. I've gone to that every year since 2011. And a lot of the people who attend that conference are, they're beyond just professional colleagues. At this point, they are friends. So if they come to Las Vegas, they stay at my home. They stay in my guest room.
Wow.
And when you have, we send each other text messages. We go out drinking together. We've just really become friends. And when you develop that level of relationship with other people who also have audiences and who also have blogs and who are also just kind of in the same space doing the same thing, I mean, it's not like you form some sort of like agreement, like I agree to cross promote you if you yeah. reciprocate, you know, like it's nothing like that. You just become, you just act like a human being and don't ask them for anything. And eventually over time, you know, they'll naturally be like, hey, you know, in one of their blog posts, they'll be like, props to my buddy Paula for telling me about XYZ.
Yeah.
And that's just how it happens.
It's way more natural that way.
Exactly. Exactly. I get really, you know, I get a lot of emails from people, typically new bloggers, who are like, you know, their approach is far too inorganic and far too formal. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll be like, hey, can you tweet me, or can you promote me, or can you link to me, or can, you know, and I'm like, no, I have no idea who you are. Yeah. You know, whereas if, Brandon's a great example. Like, I actually don't allow guest posts on my blog anymore because, like I said, because I put 20 hours into some of my content and everybody else just produces crap.
Yeah.
So I have a no guest post policy. But Brandon, because he's a friend of mine, when he emailed me and said, hey, can I write something? Can I write a guest post for your site? I was like, well, we're friends. Like, we're actually friends. So, you know, I probably even wrote back. I was like, you can do it as long as it doesn't suck, you know? And he was like, I promise it won't suck. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to hold you to it. You know, and we have that kind of relationship where we can say that to one another and it's okay.
Yeah. That makes way more sense to build those relationships and have friends that can post. And even then you still have to be, I guess, careful who you let on and who you don't let on.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've been investing now for 5 years, you got a pretty good audience of people who, you know, pay attention to how you're investing and sort of your philosophy on investing. Now you haven't done a ton of real estate deals compared to some of the big flippers out there, but surely out of the deals that you've done, there's one that's got a cool story behind it. Is there one that stands out to you as like your best deal ever?
I would say the second property that I bought. So it was my first single family home.
Okay.
Yep. And it was the first one that I actually knew what I was doing. The triplex was like an accident that I fell into.
Right.
So yeah, the first one that I bought on purpose.
This is 2012?
Yeah, this was in 2012.
Okay.
And it was a foreclosure, 3-bedroom, 2-bath. I'm pulling up the blog post right now. 1450 square feet. It was built in 1985. You can tell I'm like reading directly from the post.
Yeah.
Right. It was at its peak, it had sold for about $100,000, and I picked it up for $21,000.
Nice. What part of town was this in?
So this is South DeKalb County.
Okay. Yep.
So if you're familiar with the Atlanta area, it is technically a Decatur mailing address. Although if you were to go there, you'd be like, this is not Decatur.
Yeah.
You know, so it's Decatur in name only.
It's like unincorporated DeKalb County, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so $21,000. That's a darn good price back then, especially for something built in 85. Man, I would have been salivating over something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was awesome.
So $21,000. How much did you put into it?
$10,000.
No way. Nice.
Yeah.
So you're in it for $31,000.
Yep. And it rents for $900 a month.
Oh my gosh, Paula, that's slam dunk, man.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
That was 2012. That's what that was. That was really good timing.
Well, actually, so my most recent single family home purchase, I bought it for $46,000 and I put $15,000 into it. So I'm in it for $61,000.
Uh-huh.
And that one also rents for about $900 a month.
Okay. That's still really solid. I mean, that's not outside the realm of possible. We wholesale a number of houses in like that $40,000 to $50,000 range right now that are sort of similar to that. But the fact you got away with only 15 rehab strong, and a lot of those will rent for like $800 to $900. So you're on the high end of that at $900. That's still a really solid deal.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Same area, DeKalb?
No. So that one is in historic West End.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. West End.
Yeah.
West End's a whole other animal in and of itself. You got the really West hot End. Streets and then the really war zone streets. Just,
Yeah. For any of your listeners who are based in the Atlanta area, West End, that whole West End, Adair Park, Pittsburgh, you have to be very careful in that area.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, exactly like you said, Ken, there are some streets that are amazing and some streets that I wouldn't walk down during the daytime.
Yeah.
So.
But, you know, there's guys that are gobbling that stuff up. I mean, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a pop. And it's rough now, but you know what? I'll be kicking myself 20 years from now when every one of those houses is worth $500,000.
Mm.
Because, I mean, even though they're sketchy now, long term, that area is going to do well. And that's true with a lot of different municipalities, a lot of different areas. The war zones, you know, if there's a path of growth in that direction, I mean, if you can wait it out and deal with some troubled tenants and some crime, long term, though, you could end up doing really well in those areas.
Yeah, I mean, so my philosophy is when I buy a property, I'm buying for cash flow because I accept the fact that I don't know what the future holds.
Yep.
I can make some educated, I like to say projection is just a fancy word for guess.
Yep.
So I can make some educated guesses, but at the end of the day, I have no idea what the future holds, and also I can't really control it.
Yeah.
So I'm buying for cash flow, and if appreciation happens, that's icing on the cake.
Yeah.
Now that being said, if I find a house that has, let's say I've got two houses that both have really good cash flow, but one of them is in an area that I think has a higher chance of appreciation and the other one is not, you know, then okay, great. All else being equal, I'll go for the areas that have appreciation.
Sure.
But I'm never going to go into a bad deal or even a mediocre deal based on speculation.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely. The interesting thing, though, is a lot of times those war zone areas on paper produce a ton of cash flow.
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't that what's crazy? I mean, there is some, you are speculating that, okay, I'm going to deal with this little bit of a war zone area. I'm going to get phenomenal cash flow if I can keep a stable tenant in there. And then, you know, 20 years from now, it may be worth a ton. But even if it's not, you know, I can continue to maybe be a little more involved, deal with the rough area and have great cash flow, especially if you get like a Section 8 tenant in some of those areas. I mean, it's just insane how much they'll pay out.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the house that I bought, the most recent single family home that I bought, at the time that I bought it, the house next door was this it was vacant, boarded up, abandoned. It had a fire that had run through it. I think the owner probably torched it for insurance. I mean, it was a nightmare. So the house my home didn't even qualify for Section 8 because of the house next door. And then I brought my property manager to it and she was like, I don't want to represent that. So I had to go and find a different property manager because my property manager refused.
Bad.
Yeah, it was, that was... and yet 1 year later, here we are today, somebody bought that house next door, gutted, just raised it, built a brand new house in that area, built a brand new house in that lot, and, has it on the market for north of 200,000.
Wow.
And so I went from literally like within the span of a year, I went from being worried that the house next door was harming my property value to now being in the opposite position. Now I'm like, oh, I'm the property that's harming their value.
That's right. Yeah. They're looking at you like, come on.
Yeah,
fix
exactly.
This thing up.
And that happened in 1 year, which blows my mind.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't know what to make of that. I don't know if that's a sign of a healthy market or if that's a sign of a speculative bubble. I have no idea. And so again, that's why I just fall back on, I'm sticking with a cash flow strategy.
Yeah.
And that way, whatever happens with values happens with values, but I'm still going to get the cash flow at the end of the day.
That's right. Yeah. To your point, you don't necessarily buy a house that's not a good cash flow deal because you're just banking on appreciation.
Yeah.
At least in your case, you're getting the cash flow. And if you get the appreciation, fantastic.
Exactly. It's a bonus. It's icing on the cake. You know, it's beer money.
That's right. Exactly. Well, so interesting fun fact about the West End. And mm-hmm. this is very a specific conversation between you and me because half the people listening have no idea what we're talking about.
But this they're is, like London.
Yeah, exactly. West End, what? So, I mean, this is just a few minutes west of downtown Atlanta. But so this zip code that you're in was the number one zip code in the entire United States for mortgage fraud in the mid-2000s. Yes. You probably knew that.
Oh, yeah.
It's just such an interesting area. Oh, man, it was so hot in the mid-2000s. Then you had this bust, and then it was just, you couldn't, literally, the city was giving houses away.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are, you know, on the other end of the recession, and this area is heating back up again. Like you said, they're building a $200,000 house next door. And it's just, you never know quite where you are in that area. If it's really hot, if it's a bubble, what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
But yeah. It's so close to downtown Atlanta. That's the thing. And there's so much progress with the Beltline and new mm-hmm. things growing west. You are in the path of progress. So at some point, it does have to fully gentrify, and they will be worth a lot. It's just a matter of when. Mm-hmm. Anyways, we've been on a tangent on the West End. I love your best deal ever, though. That is such the quintessential deal, especially of houses that I've done. I've done literally hundreds of houses in DeKalb, similar mm-hmm. to what you're talking about, but maybe not quite even as strong. You got such a good deal on that $21,000. Put 10 into it and you're getting 900 in rent. Just sit on that thing forever and let it produce cash. It's just a cash machine at this point.
Yeah. My tenants for that house have been in there for 3 years. So I've gone for 3 years without a turnover.
Oh, you gotta love that. That's such a slam dunk.
Yeah. Oh, great. Nice elderly couple, they're wonderful. And in fact, actually my first tenant for that house owned these two cars that were so nice. And the value of each car was worth the value of the house.
Right.
So he had two cars with a combined worth of $60,000 and then he's renting this $30,000 house, and I was pulling up, at that point I drove like a 15-year-old Toyota Camry right. with like more than 200,000 miles on it. So I'm pulling up in this like janky car. But I'm the landlord who bought the place in cash. So there we go.
You should write a blog on that. I mean, just the discrepancy between the renters who drive nicer cars than their landlords, because there's so much truth behind that. And it so much reason for the shape our economy is in.
Yeah. Oh, I did. AffordAnything.com. Check it out.
That's right.
Yeah, I did. I think I mentioned that in one of my blog posts. Yeah, I did. I mentioned it in the blog post, right? When I announced that place had gotten rented.
That's classic. Well, so let's take a minute. Point people to your blog, and I guess tell us a little bit more about the blog and what people can find and how they can reach out to you.
Sure. So affordanything.com. Sign up for the email list. It's free. And I produce content every once in a while. I try to produce content once a week, but sometimes I make it to that. Sometimes I don't. I write mostly about buy and hold real estate investing. I write, as you might be able to tell through just my personality, I write in a way that's not so serious. So I'll write about real estate, but I'll throw in like Miley Cyrus jokes and like like PG-13 rated references. I just write in a way that's very offbeat and very like girl next door.
Yeah.
And it's not exclusively about real estate investing. It's also, true to the original like value of you can afford anything, just not everything. Mm-hmm. It also touches on a lot of smart money management, like saving, valuing your time, as well as your money. It's not like a traditional finance blog that hyper focuses on clipping coupons or, bisecting your dryer sheets or whatever,
yeah.
Unscrewing your oven light so you can save 5 cents. It's not one of those finance blogs. It has very much a like growth business investing focus.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a lot of like, this is how you reach financial independence. Cause I would consider myself to be financially free, by that I mean I don't ever have to work again. Like I can choose to.
Yeah.
And certainly being on this podcast, I would consider that to be work, but I don't have to. Like I'm not like, I gotta get on Ken Corsini's podcast in order to buy my groceries this month.
But you were pretty thrilled when I asked, right?
So a lot of it is just about making the smart decisions that will allow you to create financial freedom, and build wealth and create those investments.
Yeah. I had a chance to read one of them. I thought it was awesome. And then I was super stoked that you agreed to come on the podcast. I'll make sure that the website's on our show notes as well, folks. Again, it's affordanything.com. It's a very cool blog. Definitely suggest that you guys sign up for the newsletter. Paula, thanks again for coming on the show. This was great.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Ken.
All right. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Hey, Deal Farm Podcast listeners, this is Ken Corsini with a very special offer. I'm giving you an opportunity to work with my company, Georgia Residential Partners, and buy turnkey cash flowing properties in Atlanta for less than you've ever bought them at before. Where before we would sell properties that have already been fixed up with a markup in place, we're going to be selling properties at wholesale prices, the original wholesale prices. So instead of selling you a $70,000 house, we're going to sell you a $45,000 house. We're going to provide the hard money, the contractors, the tenant placement, the permanent financing, the insurance, everything you need to get into this house. And again, many of these properties are going to be sold $10,000 to $15,000 less than what you would have paid for them otherwise. That means you get to recognize equity right out of the gates and bring less money to the table on your permanent refi. If this is of interest to you, reach out to me at ken@gainvesting.com. Look forward to hearing from you.